up and stops and waves the other vehicles past because there's a car in front of that blocked her.
Yeah.
You know, if she'd kept going, she would have had to turn into the path of the vehicles following her. So she stops and waves them on. One goes by her. The other one stops, and they get out, and they start trying to break into her vehicle.
So we have what – I mean, this is outrageous that this has been created,
mm-hmm.
ICE in general. It is just – it's there's no defense of it. And well, I must admit, I sometimes hear the competition. Who's right now on CKNW?
Oh, I don't know.
But anyway, now this is a good reason to listen to us, because he sat on the fence. This was before the other one that we're talking about, the last one. But I think even the first one shows it. But he sort of, oh, we shouldn't jump to any conclusion on either way. And I'm going, what? I mean, it's kind of obvious that ICE is wrong, but he sat on the fence about this. I was like, oh, I'm not taking either side or something. We shouldn't. I said,
You can still use your eyes to see what's going on. I mean, speaking of jumping to conclusions, I think it's worth also talking about the reaction of administration leaders and their comments about what happened. Because right there on the same day, within, well, maybe not minutes, but very shortly thereafter, you have administration officials, Kristi Noem, who's the head of department, you know, basically coming on and characterizing the event, you know, saying a whole bunch of things, clearly intended to try and shape the narrative that, you know, this woman was a domestic terrorist, that she was trying to run over the ICE officer, that a bunch of other stuff, way before they had any information about this. How were they able to come up within a few minutes and decide that this person, who was a domestic terrorist, and of course, none of it matches the reality. Same thing with the comments of Donald Trump the same day, you know, with
J.D. Vance being the worst.
Yeah, you know, they all come out in advance of any investigation, and you know, there's what I think is really gross about what they had to say, what they were saying itself, but just the fact that they came out. And basically got way out ahead of any real information to tell a bunch of lies to shape the narrative. Says a lot about just how bad the sort of governance situation is in the States. Could you imagine, you know, if something similar happened here, you know, and, you know, whether it was, you know, the premier or the prime minister or somebody else came out, and before any information was available, they're creating characterizations, you know, slandering people, you know, basically telling a bunch of falsehoods to shape the narrative in the way they want it, based on not even having information available yet. I mean, that's just a corrupt way of doing business as a government and as a leader, because they're really, you know, they're not interested in the outcome of an actual investigation. They're not interested in respecting, you know, the different parties in the involved in the incident, or having an understanding of what actually happened before making their comments. They're interested in taking the narrative they want to put on it, and getting that out there before there's any real information. And, you know, in this age of social media, that's significant, because their followers all pick up that message and then start parroting throughout many social media platforms.
Well, the other thing is the very creation of this ICE is really bad. I mean, the very creation of it and what it's doing. So it's sort of, and it's just, I mean, they're also saying, we don't want you disagreeing with it. We don't want you doing a protest about it. I mean, in Minnesota, they're closing the schools, because in the elementary and high school, they're going out to get children. I mean, whether or not there's a reason of their citizenship. It's just across the board outrageous.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have a kid in high school, and I can only imagine if, you know, a bunch of armed and masked people showed up at the school and started grabbing students and grabbing teachers and
Well, what kind of shows they don't have any sense of, oh, why don't we just forget about people 18 or 19, people, why don't we just specialize on people 19 and older? And just forget about those younger. No, they're even going after that. They have no shame in anything that they're doing. I mean, they had a child getting cancer treatments. They sent him back to Mexico. There's no excuse for it. I mean, in their conduct. It's like it kind of shows like you could say, oh, you know, maybe why don't we just concentrate on 19 and older?
Yeah.
But they're not. They're just shameless. It's a shameless thing yeah. that they don't want any critique of. So, anyway, that's. But one thing I'm going to add, a
okay.
bit counter to Magnus here. Well, there was a bit you could argue with the. Gee, what the hell was it called? The. But the trucker convoy in Canada.
Yeah.
I mean, there were arguably. Breaches of decor by the Canadian government, how that was handled. So, but it wasn't quite ICE, though, I must admit. It wasn't quite, because one thing about that was it was about the people being involved. I think that there was a lot of unfairness with that and the trial that happened. I won't get into it now because, you know, it's a bit water under the bridge, not entirely, but ICE is decisively worse than I think how that was conducted by the Canadian government, because it is sort of just, you know, it's decisively worse, but I think freezing some person's bank account for them donating $50 is bad. Anyway, Magnus, a bit of a riffle here for the okay. morning broadcast.
All right. Anyway, thanks to Matthew Fraser for that excellent interview. He's got another interview he's working on that he'll hopefully be bringing to one of our Speak Ups either this week or next week. Tune in again for that. Right now it's time for Bird Note, and we'll be back right after that with a report about efforts to manage invasive species in the Bay of Fundy.
Just doing the songs of two common finches provide a steady soundtrack in cities across North America. There's the house finch. And the American goldfinch. While they can sound similar, a couple of key features help set them apart. House finches sing sweetly, but often have a sharp, buzzy note near the end. Listen. American goldfinches improvise the order of their songs, which can make them confusing to ID at first. But the songs have a few things in common. Goldfinches sing rapidly, often repeating a note several times. And while not part of the song, a singing American goldfinch might make the species' signature call, which sounds a bit like someone saying, "potato chip." So, one more time. Here's a house finch, more melodic and with a buzzy note near the end. And here's an American goldfinch saying potato chip and repeating notes. Listen for these birds singing over the sidewalk from spring to the end of summer. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Support for Bird Note is provided by Mary Piggott from Seattle, Washington, and generous listeners around the world.
Over the course of some decades, the invasive European green crab has upset the balance of the ecosystem of parts of the coastal Bay of Fundy in southwest New Brunswick. In an attempt to control the species and mitigate the damage it does to the area's biodiversity, the Government of Canada this week announced a commercial fishery pilot for European green crab in southwest New Brunswick to open in the spring of next year. Local 107.3 FM spoke with Robert McDougall, Area Chief of Resource Management for the Department of Fisheries and Oceans in southwest New Brunswick, about the fishery, its potential benefit to the local economy, and how it is hoped it will lessen the negative impacts and reduce the spread of the species.
So there were two waves of introduction of green crab that we know of, one in the 1950s and one in the 1980s. Since that time, green crab have become prolific throughout the Bay of Fundy and other locations in the Maritimes. And we wanted to start this fishery to help control the population, because green crab do have a detrimental impact on the ecology of the Bay of Fundy. Some of the ecological effects that we've seen, or that we've received information from, I should say, from our indigenous communities and our industry members, is that the green crab has a decimating impact on the dulse beds. They also predate on shell clams, so the clam population in the clam flats is reduced. They are also a predator of the juvenile species of all of the other native fish in the Bay of Fundy, including commercial fish, because those juvenile species exist in the near shore area where the green crab are most prolific. When you have a predator that is prolific in the same place that juvenile species are, they're going to get eaten. How many? I don't know. But we want to be able to reduce the population as much as we can to allow the native species to thrive once more.
How will the commercial fishery help to sort of, I'm assuming not to necessarily eradicate, but control numbers and spread. I mean, do you want to tell me a little bit about kind of how it should help?
Well, you're exactly correct, Iona, this isn't an eradication fishery. We would hope that they are, because they are an invasive species and we would like to see them go away. However, it's more likely that this will help control the population. So that's the framework that we're using for this particular pilot for 2026, is that it's a control fishery through a commercial license, eligible to certain individuals. Those individuals would be commercial license holders that actively fished in 2025. See, the fishery was designated under a communal license in 2025, or they have proof of that being a commercial dulse harvester in 2025. Those three eligibility criteria will indicate who is eligible for a license. And based on that, we want to get as many eligible fishers in fishing green crab in order to control the population. The point from the DFO standpoint is to control the green crab population. How do we do that? If we have a fishery that is commercialized that allows to sail a green crab, more individuals are going to want to catch the green crab.
I was wanting to ask a little bit about what effect that will have on the industry in the area, and what can European green crab be used for?
Sure. So this will support the local, it'll support our indigenous communities and our commercial fishers, existing commercial fishers, in diversifying their portfolios for fishing, which is the blue economy strategy for the government of Canada. That's the hope for the fishery to support industry. Now, in terms of what can green crab be used for, really the sky's the limit, provided that whatever they're being sold for is appropriately authorized. For example, green crab can be used as bait for other fisheries, provided that it's dead. It can be used for compost, so like your organic soils for your garden. And there is the possibility that it could be processed for food. That would have to go through the appropriate approvals with the Canadian Food Inspection Agencies, but all of those post-landing sales aren't the mandated DFO, but they're options to the fishers and to the industry in terms of making the green crab a marketable product that will support the control fishery.
This is just a pilot for 1 year, I understand. And will this potentially be expanded after the year? Is there a broader area that would be needed to control the species?
Well, I can't really answer the future. That's not within my care and control. But in terms of what's the intent, well, hopefully this fishery does have a measure of control of the population, which would be helpful, because green crab, if we don't eradicate green crab, we have to control them, and you can only control them if you do it constantly.
What other options are there other than commercial fisheries for control of invasive species like this?
There is what's called the Section 52 Aquatic Invasive Species Control License, and it does not allow the sale of green crab, right? That is for individuals, typically organizations, non-governmental organizations, and ecological groups who want to help control the population of green crab, but there would be no sale post-landing. It would be only for the purpose of destruction at this time.
And then sort of in broader terms, how can the introduction of invasive species like European green crab, how can they be sort of prevented in the first place?
In Canada, the introduction of any live fish into another fish habitat is prohibited under the Fisheries Act and regulations. So one way to prevent the spread of any aquatic invasive species, specifically the green crab, is that you ensure that if you have any live wells or if you have anything on the side of your boat and you're going from one location to another, that you thoroughly clean them. And if you go on the DFO website for aquatic invasive species, there's quite an extensive information piece on how to clean your boat. There's the optional chemicals or processes, etc. For green crab, it's ensuring that you don't inadvertently take a live green crab or anything from one location, like for example, the Bay of Fundy, and take it to another part, another ocean in Canada, which may or may not have juvenile green crab or whatnot on, like rocks or seaweed or clamshells, etc. You want to keep those out of the water. For fishers that are interested, that based on the eligibility criteria that I explained, we do have two information sessions happening: one tomorrow on Graham and Anne, and one in St. George on Friday. That information has been distributed to all of the advisory committee and the fishers representatives. If they're interested and they're listening, I would encourage them to reach out to their association or industry representative and determine when and where they need to be if they would like to join.
If you have a tip, an idea, or a story you think the community should hear about, you can contact Local 107.3 FM at iona@cfmh.ca. This is Iona Coe for Local 107.3 FM and the Local Journalism Initiative.
And now something from Begonia's new album. She's out on tour. Well, she's not. She's got a new album out now and is heading out on tour next month throughout Europe in February, March, and April, ending with a show in London, England on April 26th. This is from her new album, Hotter Than the Sun. Well, the song is called Hotter Than the Sun.
The pounding in my head, the making of my bed. Some things I'm quick to tend to, others overwhelm me. Why there's something inside that makes me want to hate myself. My need for validation, self-asphyxiation of my medication. Oh, and then an everyday sedation. My sexual frustration, boxing at service stations to the novelty war thin.
Never made. I get people paid.
Begonia from her new album, Fantasy Life. That was Hotter Than the Sun. All right, so
Peter. If next week we'll talk about the silver prices and all that. But here is something, I have something that I know comprehensively. I had to talk about a 1943 film, Mission to Moscow, Hollywood, big budget, well, not the biggest budget in the world, but it lost a bit of money by Warner Brothers. Jack Warner said during the McCarthy era, it was a bit of an error. But it was actually egged on by the United States government. It's it details how they were getting the Soviet Union involved with the war effort or the United States involved. It was... Yeah.
Well, of course, in 1943...
They
were allied in their war fight against Nazi Germany.
Now, this is something that Adam brought up, and I'm going to... I know it's always kind of bad to read, but I'm going to read it because it's a bit detailed. Now, there was some other, at the time, not as much, because it was kind of a political thing, Mission to Moscow. It was a, what do you call it, like your, the Mission to Moscow is about, he has some ambassador from the United States to try to get it. So it's, the other ones were more kind of lighthearted. There was one at MGM, major studio, Song of Russia, I think it, which I haven't seen, but it was sort of just probably just a romance or something. But Adam enlightened me this to it, and I'm going to read here. Actor Robert Taylor claimed he was forced by his studio, MGM, and the U.S. government to appear in the 1944 film Song of Russia. During World War II, the U.S. government encouraged Hollywood to produce pro-Soviet films to support the alliance against Nazi Germany. Taylor, who was a conservative and an anti-communist, had already volunteered for the U.S. Navy and expected to start immediately, you know, be part of the U.S. Navy. However, according to Taylor's later testimony at the House of Un-American Activities in 1947, MGM allegedly told him to just do the picture or face a breach of contract suit. A representative from President Roosevelt's Office of War supposedly threatened to block his Navy commission if he refused the role. So how things change, how things can change. Now, there was... James Agee was sort of... I still think he's still seen as an important film critic. Mm-hmm. He wrote for Time magazine and The Actual Nation. Now, he wrote a negative review in 1943 about the film. Now
this, which film was this? Was this
Mission to Moscow?
Okay.
Now, he wasn't exactly in the McCarthyite. Oh. Period. He wasn't exactly really attacked. He died at a premature age around 1956. He did back up Chaplin in 1947 against attacks. He could have been somebody who a real a McCarthyite would have been kind of wary of him. However, and we probably had progressive attitudes. But however, I don't have the entire review, but in 1943, writer James Agee reviewed the controversial film Mission Moscow, calling it a great, glad $2 million bowl of canned borscht and a mishmash, heavily criticizing its pro-Soviet propaganda and portrayal of the Stalin purges as being necessary. And actually, this is one thing about the film which I came up with this topic.
Now, have you watched the film?
I've seen it a number of times. Hmm. I didn't see it last night, though. But one thing that I do remember is that they whitewashed the trials during the 30s.
Yeah.
And as, I mean, it's a complete whitewash of, in fact, they even have an actor playing Joseph Stalin with his pipe and all this. It's pretty over the top. Okay.
And for those who don't know the history, during the Stalin conducted a pretty significant purge of within Russia, including within the Communist Party, of anyone he felt was perhaps a threat to his position as head of the party. And some of it, you know, was characterized as anti-revolutionary behavior, but it was quite a, they called it a reign of terror, because that's kind of the kind of arbitrary arrest and conviction and punishment that happened there.
So Warner Brothers in the early 50s did a film called I Was a Communist for the FBI, sort of turning, I guess, Jack Warner thought he had to sort of make up for it. And actually, what it was the McCarthyite era, as such, starts in early 1950 when Joseph McCarthy presented this thing that supposedly there were communists in the government and so on. And the Soviets had not obtained the atomic bomb until 1949. So there was sort of a period. I consider the McCarthyite period really ending after World War II myself, even though Joseph McCarthy was just some senator. It was not really I'm taking the term McCarthyite to be more than just one person. But Hollywood had the in 1947, actually. That was before the Soviets obtained the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. But it kind of shows how the thing about propaganda is that they want you to believe a thing that often is just for a certain time period, and you are to totally forget about what was said to you previously. That's sort of what's brought up in George Orwell's 1984, that mm-hmm. you don't, like, we will tell you this, but we'll tell you something else later on, but forget about what we said previously. And it is, and it was interesting about James and G. Really, I had read quite a while ago the actual review, and he just rebukes the whole thing. And what he is rebuking is this concept of this, of anything trying to tell you a line and trying to tell you something in a very specific mm-hmm. way.
Well, it's interesting. I just have it searched on Google here, and just the very first lines from some of the listings. You know, Wikipedia says, Mission to Moscow is a 1943 propaganda film directed by Michael Curtis based on the 1941 book by the former U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union. Then for the IMDb says, Ambassador Joseph Davies is sent by FDR to Russia to learn about the Soviet system and returns to America as an advocate of Stalinism. How does that? You've seen the film?
Yes, I've seen it a number of times.
We got 30 seconds.
Well, what happened was that in 1956, Warner Brothers sold their pre-1948 library to AAP, and later it was United Artists. They did not have, as part of that package, Mission to Moscow, but it was first shown on PBS during the 1970s, and CBC late night used to show late night movies. They obtained a package of Warner Brothers films during the 80s. It's where I saw it and videotaped it, and that was before Glasnost. I saw it too, so it was a bit interesting to see the film then.
All right. Thanks for listening today, Democracy Now!